With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on this Monday here on the AgNet News Hour. We're seeing increased pistachio shipments to the Middle East and Africa. Also, farm evaluations. We'll have more on that for rice growers. But our top story today, things must change between the Ag Committee's two leaders and the two parties if the new year is to see a new farm bill. Those words from longtime Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. He sees more trouble ahead for farm bill efforts next year if the two sides and the chair and ranking member remain dug in on their positions.
What I've observed in the last 6 months is resistance by Democrats to putting more farm in the farm bill, which basically means increase in reference pricing. And secondly, mostly an issue between Stabenow and Bozeman is this issue over the, if you save money in one title, you can't spend in another title. And until those things are worked out, and I don't believe they've been worked out, we aren't going to make any progress in the Senate.
Meanwhile, House Agriculture Committee Chairman Glenn G.T. Thompson says he now hopes to move a new farm bill by March. The nation is now 2 months into fiscal year 2024, and Congress has yet to provide additional funding for nutrition programs, including the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC. WIC provides nutrition assistance for almost 6.7 million pregnant women, new mothers, babies, and young children across the country. Congress has fully funded WIC for more than 25 years. However, the program's funding needs have grown recently due to higher-than-expected participation and food costs. During a call with reporters, the director of the Domestic Policy Council, Neera Tanden, stressed the importance of the WIC program.
The evidence is crystal clear. WIC means healthier babies who are more likely to survive infancy. Down the line, those babies are more likely to receive medical care. And as toddlers and school children, children who are on WIC perform better on tests of mental development and reading. So really, this funding for WIC and fully funding WIC is a no-brainer.
This is especially troubling because WIC serves nearly 40% of all infants in the United States.
USDA Deputy Secretary Social Torres-Small agrees.
We've seen that it drives down healthcare costs and increases preventative care. Studies show that WIC decreases infant deaths, premature births, and also reduces the risk of low birth weights. And in early childhood, WIC participation is also associated with higher test scores.
If Congress fails to provide the additional funds, the program will see a $1 billion shortfall, and about 2 million participants nationwide will have to leave the program by September. If Congress extends the current funding level rather than providing the additional funds needed, USDA could take measures to protect the program. However, it would only be able to close about half of that $1 billion gap. What does USDA's latest America's Farms and Ranches at a Glance report indicate regarding what size farms produced what type of commodities? Rod Bain looks into it.
When it comes to the makeup of farms in the U.S., most, 97% specifically, are family farms. And most of those, 88%, are small-sized family farms. But what is the makeup of production by commodity for farms? USDA economic researcher Catherine Lacey says, based on the latest America's Farms and Ranches at a Glance report covering calendar year 2022,
large-scale family farms dominate the production of most commodities, including beef, hogs, cash grains and soybeans, cotton, dairy, and specialty crops. In the remaining two commodities, poultry and eggs, and hay, small family farms and mid-sized family farms dominate the production.
As for non-family farms, commodity production value ranges from 5% of all poultry and eggs produced in our nation last year to 19% of all specialty crops produced in 2022. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just want to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have our statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen, and we will be back in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. In today's National Spotlight, Wisconsin produces 60% of the U.S. cranberry crop. It's the top state in the nation. Michael Gardner manages 1,200 acres of cranberries at Gardner Cranberry in Pittsville, Wisconsin. He says they protect cranberries in the winter with a layer of ice over the cranberry bogs.
So you want to make ice over the top of the vines to protect from frost getting down into the roots of the vines and potentially killing them and keep them out of the wind and stuff like that. So snow cover is really great.
Going through the Wisconsin winter season, with some warmer days, ice may not last.
Yeah, so typically we try to look out for cold, windy days, really cold. Otherwise, usually try to make 12 to 18 inches of ice on top of the vines. Just got to kind of be prepared for what Mother Nature gives us.
So what do cranberry bogs look like?
They look like, if you look at a bed, they just look like leaves down there. The runners can be like 3 feet long. It just looks like a sea of leaves is what it looks like.
In other news, the United Soybean Board's infrastructure investments go a long way for American agriculture, Chad Smith tells us.
The United Soybean Board engages in a number of infrastructure investments designed to keep U.S. soybean growers in a global leadership position while also benefiting transport of other commodities and agricultural inputs. USB Director and Maryland farmer Belinda Burrier speaks to some of the latest projects.
The dredging of the Lower Mississippi River and the amount of partnership that we have building this, increasing the depth of the river, actually increases the amount of production that we can send down to the river and out export and across the world. And the second one is Port of Grays Harbor terminal expansion in Washington State.
These infrastructure investments by the checkoff in research, analysis, and design benefit soybean producers and other commodities too.
I was at both of these ports this year and have seen the investments that we have done with our partners, and it has increased their expansion of direct routes to Southeast Asia and other ports across the entire Pacific Rim. So it's really a big plus for the farmers, especially in the Midwest.
She says the investments have a big impact on U.S. soybean exports.
They sure do, and it's increased the amount that we can ship by over 60% to other ports across the world, and that brings value back to the farm gate as far as it goes, and we can ship our product knowing that we have this support infrastructure-wise.
Keep up with the latest news from the United Soybean Board at unitedsoybean.org and Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central on RFD-TV. Chad Smith reporting.
In livestock news, will beef cattle prices continue to rise next year? Gary Crawford looks into it.
Cow-calf operators seem to be continuing to send more animals to feedlots than normal, sooner than normal.
Higher placements happening right now are going to translate into a little bit larger supplies in the first few months of 2024.
But USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says supplies of cattle in 2024 as a whole will still be lower than this year. And as to prices, they've been running a little lower than expected recently.
But still, overall, steer prices are relatively strong and expected to increase in 2024.
For this year, steer prices are expected to average a very high 175.55 hundredweight.
We expect that to increase next year with even tighter supplies to $178.25 per hundredweight.
A 1.5% increase as cattle supplies tighten, sending 2024 beef production down by 3.5%. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Larger supplies of an agricultural commodity usually push prices for that commodity down, but for one livestock sector, that may not be true for 2024. Here's Gary Crawford once again.
What are the market prospects for the nation's pork producers?
There isn't a lot to say about pork right at this point.
By that now, USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says his team of analysts don't want to change the basics of their previous pork-related forecasts until after USDA releases its quarterly hogs and pigs inventory report. That comes on the 22nd. But checking on what they have been saying up to now, it looks like for 2024, pork production and hog prices both will be higher than this year. On the price side,
prices are expected to be up year over year. For our 2023 prices, forecast at $58.70 per hundredweight. That's expected to increase to $60 per hundredweight in 2024.
This 2% higher price coming even with a projected 2% increase in pork output next year. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Four tribal nations were first recipients of a USDA grant program designed to strengthen food sovereignty and expand local and regional supply chains. Rod Bain has more.
We're announcing four awards totaling just over $4 million. Two are in Alaska. The Alatik tribe of Old Harbor in Alaska will use a $1 million grant to buy and modernize an unused processing facility that will help the community address food shortages due to climate change. Members of the tribe live in a remote village accessible only by boat or small plane, and severe weather can delay food deliveries and outyear depleting fishing stocks. The funding will allow the tribe to increase the amount of local game and fish they can process using traditional methods. This includes meat from the Sitladek bison herd that the tribe manages. In addition, the Palawa Dene Nation in Southern Oregon and Northern California will use a $2.4 million grant to expand a food sovereignty program that provides the community a space and resources to learn traditional processing methods for local game and fish, including black-tailed deer, Roosevelt elk, and Chinook salmon. The grant will allow the tribe to pay for three staff positions, buy a mobile processing unit, and outfit a recently built 6,000-square-foot food sovereignty building with new equipment.
A first-of-its-kind USDA grant program is increasing food sovereignty and supply chain resiliency within tribal nations.
USDA Rural Development, with the help and expertise of the Agricultural Marketing Service, has created this program as a direct response to requests from tribal nations.
Rural Development, Rural Business Cooperative Service Administrator Karama Neal says four tribal nations are inaugural recipients of Indigenous Animals Harvesting and Meat Processing Grants.
These first four awards total more than $4 million. There will be nearly $50 million in awards that will be made eventually.
In terms of what grants will mean for specific projects, the administrator points to creation of local tribal-owned businesses and jobs associated with such entities, as well as a source for processed meats to assist tribal families in need.
So when you think about that longer-term aspect, those are the kinds of things that we're looking forward to seeing.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. Brian German has today's AgNet West headlines.
Global demand for California pistachios has remained consistent throughout 2023 with strong shipment numbers. Last month, then-president of American Pistachio Growers, Richard Matoyan, said that while the European Union is still the number one export destination, there have been considerable gains made in several other important markets.
So we saw a tremendous increase in Middle East and Africa, and the three countries that really make up that export number would be United Arab Emirates, and we know that Dubai, specifically where it's shipped to, a lot of product is then transshipped elsewhere, but we're seeing large increase in Saudi Arabia and also in Turkey. And Turkey is a producer of product, but we see a tremendous amount of product going into the country of Turkey.
The Fertilizer Institute celebrated the release of the Hypoxia Task Force's 2023 report to Congress last month, highlighting substantial progress in achieving the goals of the 2008 Gulf Hypoxia Action Plan. TFI President and CEO Corey Rosenbusch expressed enthusiasm, noting a 20% decrease in nitrogen loads, surpassing the 2025 target. The decline is attributed to growers adopting nutrient stewardship practices, particularly the 4 R's, emphasizing responsible fertilizer use. Rosenbusch also emphasized the positive impact of voluntary adoption of science and industry-backed conservation practices by farmers and ranchers on water quality. TFI plans to leverage the report to further educate growers and policymakers about the advantages of nutrient stewardship practices, asserting that smart application enhances yields and provides a variety of other benefits. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Farm Service Agency has introduced an online application process for direct farm loan customers, aiming to streamline processes and enhance customer service. The online format offers an interactive and paperless application featuring an electronic signature option, document attachments, balance sheet completion, and farm operating plan creation. The application process involves creating a USDA customer account and a login.gov account. FSA has also simplified the paper farm loan application to 13 pages for those still using the traditional method. Borrowers can track their loan application progress through a personalized dashboard. Additionally, FSA has implemented measures to assist distressed borrowers, offering relief and expediting support for those facing financial risks in their agricultural operations. Rice growers are required to submit a farm evaluation and nitrogen management plan to the California Rice Commission every 5 years as part of the Central Valley Water Board waste discharge requirement. The evaluation provides information on grower compliance with the order, with the CRC compiling data for a summary submitted to the board. Reporting for the 2023 crop year is required by March 1st, with an online submission link available on the CRC website beginning in January. The plan serves as a tool for growers in planning nitrogen applications with information submitted to the CRC but not disclosed to the board. Growers use unique identification numbers, and data reported to the board is aggregated by township without individual grower or parcel identification. Plans must be electronically available at the grower's operational headquarters, and inspection copies must be provided upon request to board staff. The 2024 annual Rice Growers Meetings are coming up in a few weeks. The program for each of the meetings will be the same, consisting of updates on disease management, fertility, and weed management. There will also be updates from local county ag commissioners and an update from the Rice Experiment Station. The meetings on January 9th will be held at the Evangelical Church in Richvale and the Glynn County Office of Education in Willows. The January 10th meetings will be held at the SIP Conference Room in Colusa and the Veterans Hall in Yuba City. The final meeting on January 11th will be held at Norton Hall in Woodland. The Richvale, Colusa, and Woodland meetings will begin at 8:30 in the morning, and the Glynn and Yuba City meetings will begin at 1:30 in the afternoon. More information about the Rice Growers meeting is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Most farmers have to predict demand for their products 1 year ahead. For Christmas tree growers, it's 10 years. Gary Crawford has more.
Ah, yes, here's that Christmas tree hunting clip again from the movie A Christmas Story.
Haven't you got a big tree?
Yeah, this here is a tree.
Don't you think it's a little large?
Yeah, no, Christmas only comes once a year. Why not?
Why not?
If you went hunting for a real Christmas tree after the first week of December this year, you may have had a little trouble finding just the right tree. Some farms and tree lots sold out of trees this year. One reason goes back 12 to 15 years ago, when artificial trees were reducing demand for the real ones, and many tree farmers cut back on planting new trees. But then, about 3 years ago, demand for real trees started climbing again. And so here lately, many farmers have increased plantings of trees again, which will be ready in about another 10 years. But as the executive director of the National Christmas Tree Association, Tim O'Connor, says, the question is,
if the plantings now that have been occurring will match demand when those trees are ready.
So in other words, as one choose and cut tree grower tells me,
you got to be forward thinking in the tree business.
Very forward thinking. Jim Gelson runs this farm. He owns it in Northern Virginia, where we get our trees every year. And he says it is a quandary unique to the tree business.
What's happening now isn't the case for 8 years out.
He says, though, that for the big growers to have cut back plantings 12 years ago, that was, as he puts it,
kind of short-sighted,
thinking that the real Christmas tree market was going to be permanently shrinking. In fact, Jim Gelson thinks just the opposite. He's going around doing presentations to groups of farmers and would-be farmers, telling them,
look, forget about hemp. Plant Christmas trees. It's here now. You don't have to get federal regulation, federal permits or anything. It's good to go. Get some acreage, plant some trees.
And he even has some numbers to prove his case.
If you get trees for 20 cents a piece, sorry, I'm going to put 5,000 Norway spruce out in the spring. That's $1,000. In 12 years, they'll be worth $1 million. What else can you invest in to get a return like that?
No, wait a minute, though. That's 12 years, Jim, with no income. Now, how am I going to keep going without any income?
You got to believe in yourself, man.
Yeah, you laugh, but it's risky now.
But it's calculated risk. So you've got an idea of where your return is, what your odds of return are.
Which is why Jim is not planting hemp.
No, because that's an unproven market right now. You know, I don't know if the buying end is out there, so I'm not going there.
But he says Christmas trees are solid commodities with solid demand now.
Yeah, and I think the future looks good.
It does. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. World leaders met for the UN Climate Conference COP28 this month, and one thing that came out of it was a request for everyone to eat less beef. You can imagine that's not sitting well with our cattle producers. My friend and colleague Susan Littlefield of Nebraska's Rural Radio Network talked with Nebraska Congressman Mike Flood, who heard that request and not only said no, but introduced a resolution condemning it. Here's Susan Littlefield with Congressman Mike Flood.
By now, I'm sure you've already heard about COP28 and meat. Folks at the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization sending out a memo wanting the Western Hemisphere to eat less red meat. One U.S. congressman taking the bull by the horns, shall we say, and has introduced a resolution. Congressman Mike Flood giving his initial reaction to that news release out of COP28.
I thought, whoa, the global elitists are up to it again.
So then the next move was you introducing a resolution.
When you live in Nebraska and you hear what's coming out of Dubai, it's so nonsensical. Your first reaction is, who are these people and where do they come from? But then I was like, you know, if we don't push back when this stuff is said, you never know who buys into this garbage. And all of this stuff going on in Dubai with all the world leaders and they're serving big, juicy, fat hamburgers at the conference, which I think is fantastic. But yet they want to reduce beef consumption in the name of climate change. The true environmentalists are actually the farmers and ranchers that live and work in places like Nebraska in the middle of our country. We have more invested in the future health of, you know, the land that we work and the ecosystem that we contribute to. But one of the things that I think has gone completely off the rails is this idea that if we get rid of beef, that somehow the world's going to be better off. And the reality is there's a lot of places in this world that you know, won't be fed if Nebraska beef producers are on the sidelines.
You know, we're known so well for that golden triangle. And that's a perfect example of what Nebraskans do to feed the world.
Yeah, you know, it only takes 3 ounces of beef to deliver the same amount of protein in 3 cups of quinoa, you know. And to your point, it's one of the most efficient ways to deliver protein, you know. In our beef state, cattle are a critical part of the Golden Triangle that's supplying clean ethanol fuel around the world. I just met with a bunch of biofuels folks this morning, and they were reacting to this and just shaking their heads about what a disaster it would be if this actually got any traction. And the support that I'm getting from my colleagues in the House has been tremendous. Ashley Hinson from Iowa, she's taken this mantle up and she's signed on to the resolution. And I've talked to House leadership and said we need to send a strong message.
What about from the Senate side? Are you going to see any folks kind of doing the same thing that you've done on the House side?
I imagine. I'm having actually prime rib tomorrow night with Deb Fisher and Pete Ricketts. So I'm sure this will be a topic of conversation. Both of our U.S. senators have already talked to me about the resolution, and I'm sure they're as interested as I am in seeing something pass from both houses. But at the end of the day, we just have to push back. We can't take for granted that these ludicrous ideas aren't gaining traction in some corners of the world, and we have a lot at stake here. Not only feeding the world and providing these proteins and this, feeding the rest of the people. We also have to protect our way of life. And as you said, with the Golden Triangle, everything's working together. And these rural communities only exist if we have everything working in sync. And this would completely unwind our economic future for rural America and especially Nebraska.
And you find it interesting that our ag secretary was there and really not a lot of comments from him in regards to the whole statement about beef.
Yeah, and I was talking to some folks today about what was said there. And my sense, you know, Secretary Vilsack, you know, he's born and bred in Iowa. He knows how important beef production is. He knows what underpins these rural communities. When he has the opportunity to weigh in, I'll be very interested to see what he has to say. But my sense is that he knows what this means for America and what this means for states like Nebraska. There should be an immediate reaction to this from the Biden administration. And I'm sure it has to go up all the way through the White House as to what the official response is. But at the end of the day, we're talking about the world's food security, and the idea of walking away from beef is just ludicrous.
Well, you got the reaction, Governor Pillen applauding for what you did.
Yes. Governor Pillen, right away, he saw what was going on. And, you know, having a governor that's that invested in agriculture, somebody that lives and works it, you know, obviously pork, the other white meat, very, he's very familiar with this industry. And, you know, he he knows what's at stake. And I think that's one of the great things about the Nebraska delegation. We know where our bread's buttered. We know that beef is the number one industry in Nebraska, and we have to celebrate the fact we're number one in the United States. And this is something we do. We do very well. We do safely. We feed the world. You know, I drive through Cumming County a couple times every week, and every time I hit the county line, it says, "Welcome to Cumming County, doing our part to feed the world." And they are, just like all the other cattle producers in Nebraska and the nation. So I hope that the people in our state know that our representatives in Washington are focused on pushing back, making the case for a meat being a nutrient-rich source of protein that's tasty and is an efficient way to deliver calories and vitamins. And also reducing food insecurity across the world. So we've got a lot going for us. We just need to make our pitch and make sure that we push back at every chance and every corner.
I'm Susan Littlefield, the Rural Radio Network.
This is the AgConnect News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgConnect News Hour. Here's Brian German with today's featured interview.
My name is Rob Trice. I'm the founder of Better Food Ventures and The Mixing Bowl.
And you were part of a panel here at the Organic Grower Summit today, kind of focused on AI and some of the components that make that up and maybe what's on the horizon. So let's just kind of start a little bit from a bird's eye of where that conversation went and some of the points that were raised there.
Well, yeah, so we try to point out that AI is like the end of a digital journey, right? So for a producer, you can't just, you know, embrace this AI fairy dust. You actually have to crawl before you walk, before you run. And that the biggest barrier to the adoption of digital agriculture in general and AI is the farmer's notebook and the three-ring binder. And we need to go get clean data that is machine-readable in some standardized or interoperable format that we can then feed into learning models for AI, for instance.
That's one thing that we've covered before that is just kind of been a bit of an issue, is just the overall idea of data. What to do with it, what's useful. I mean, what were some of the points there in terms of maybe working towards standardization? I mean, what are some of the components of how that might be possible?
Yeah, somebody asked that question, like, well, who's got good standard data or standardized data? And look, there's a couple different ways you can look at this. For instance, in the Midwest, you got the John Deere Op Center, right? That works well on a tractor with over 150 horsepower. Won't do much out here, especially though, when you have all the smarts or the implements in the back. If we actually think about it, there are organizations that are working on this stuff, like a group called Ag Gateway, another one called the Purdue Open Ag Technology System Center. There's a startup called Leaf that creates APIs for different ag companies. It's an ag API focused company. So there's work being done, but more has to happen. The other point is we have a lot of academics that have worked to standardize terms and so forth. And a lot of those folks, they've done good research, they're just sitting collecting dust on a shelf, and it needs to get out into the market more.
And as part of that, what seems to be or what's going to be some of those points of data that are maybe most beneficial? Because some conversations have been some farmers are just drowning in data. You're collecting too much. What are some of the points of emphasis there that might rise to the top towards some of that standardization?
Well, I'm jumping ahead a little bit. One of our panelists was Derek Acevedo from Bowles Farming. He said, "I got plenty of data. I need actionable data. I need an alert to tell me something is wrong, that I need to go check on something. You know, the solar panel needs to be clean." So I think maybe that's the issue, which is maybe not what data, but what problem can be solved. You know, we were talking about, for instance, some of the weeding solutions. They're using AI and they're doing the job well right now.
So there are some applications or areas like weeding that some of that AI technology is already being used and found to be valuable. Sounds like it might be the next step of that actionable data and making that standardized to where maybe growers become more familiar with it, because right now there's a lot of terms thrown out that might not necessarily be understood by everybody right now.
Well, that's exactly right. I talked to, I shared this story on stage today about my Alabama cotton farmer friend who harrowed her field. she was using an Australian FMIS company and she wanted to log that activity. The Australians refer to a harrow as a light tickle. And so she couldn't find harrow. And she sure as heck thought light tickle meant something else. So that's where we need that standardization of term pretty badly.
And now just kind of looking ahead and based on the conversations from the people on the panel, what were some of the other things that were maybe identified as what has the potential right now or maybe is applied right now that seems to be working, but maybe they'd like to build on more a little bit?
Yeah, I think the things that I think there's easy challenges, you know, regarding like asset management, deployment, resources, optimization, that can be solved with easy amounts of data. We just need to get those things lined up, right? So that's kind of where I think that low-hanging fruit exists. Speaking of low-hanging fruit, though, probably the holy grail of this automation is harvest. So, like, that's one of the most complex things that AI is going to allow us to do. We've actually invested in a company that's doing tomato harvesting for greenhouses indoors, right, which is an easier environment. That's where, once we've achieved that with the automation, that's going to be when we've done what we need to do.
And just lastly here, as part of the development of that kind of technology and those things move forward, what's going to be the step for that? More farmers engaging with tech, or tech engaging more with farmers, or trying to find that balance in between the two?
So there's a balance, and this is where like I really tip my hat to folks like at the Western Growers for actually leading an initiative to come up with common libraries, imaging libraries that can be leveraged by others, right, for the whole industry. That's where the kind of bridge needs to happen to make the technology accessible, or the data accessible for producers, for tech providers, as well as producers.
Thank you to Brian German. This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will return in just a moment. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour, and now for more news. A small farm cooperative in British Columbia has continued to grow a variety of potato that was outlawed almost 50 years ago. Here's Dennis Guy.
Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, which tests, approves, and certifies farm crops for seed sales and commercial production, decertified the caribou variety potato back in 1976. Growing a decertified crop for commercial market purposes is illegal under federal law. But the Horse Lake Farm Cooperative still produces the caribou potato because this particular variety does so well in the BC Central Interior's cool, wet growing season, where many potato varieties do not grow very well. Rob Deether, a potato specialist and a member of the Horse Lake Farm Cooperative, says that a number of years ago, the cooperative received a letter from Agriculture Canada to stop growing the caribou variety or face a $10,000 fine.
It was decommissioned, deregistered, and then when that happens, the commercial growers are not allowed to grow it. They can only grow a registered variety of potato or to sell them as seed. It is a bit of an outlaw potato. We were told there was a $10,000 fine for growing a variety of potato that you weren't supposed to be growing. That's a lot of money.
Caribou is a medium-sized, yellow-skinned potato with unique pink blotches around the eyes. Rob Deether says there were several reasons for the potato's decertification. The caribou is quite sunlight sensitive, so should be put in dark storage right after harvesting. And there are other reasons as well.
The very large foliage, vines are so thick that they would clog up the harvesting machines. And also, it's quite sensitive to sunlight. They go green quite quickly in the supermarkets. It's certainly not uncommon for Agriculture Canada to run a certain variety of potatoes for a certain time and then replace them. We just thought it was quite absurd that you weren't legally allowed to grow them. We've declared a truce.
Agriculture Canada has agreed that the Horse Lake Farm Cooperative in British Columbia can grow the potato variety on a limited scale. A few years back, Harrowsmith magazine wrote an article that attracted fairly widespread attention. Rob Deether says that the Horse Lake Farm Cooperative will send out a couple of potatoes to those people who contact them while seasonal supplies last, so the outlawed caribou potato doesn't die out.
Letters from all over Canada and the U.S. wanted to grow out some of these potatoes. Somebody from Corner Brook, Newfoundland, enclosed fined $2 to cover expenses and perseverance in dealing with government agricultural departments. Always try to have two or three rows of caribou potatoes.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
And we return now to our top stories today. Things must change between the Ag Committee's two leaders and the two parties if the new year is to see a new farm bill. Those words from longtime Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. He sees more trouble ahead for farm bill efforts next year if the two sides and the chair and ranking member remain dug in on their positions.
What I've observed in the last 6 months is resistance by Democrats to putting more farm in the farm bill, which basically means increase in reference pricing. And secondly, mostly an issue between Stabenow and Bozeman, is this issue over the, if you save money in one title, you can't spend in another title. And until those things are worked out, and I don't believe they've been worked out, we aren't going to make any progress in the Senate.
Meanwhile, House Agriculture Committee Chairman Glenn G.T. Thompson says he now hopes to move a new farm bill by March. The nation is now 2 months into fiscal year 2024, and Congress has yet to provide additional funding for nutrition programs, including the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC. WIC provides nutrition assistance for almost 6.7 million pregnant women, new mothers, babies, and young children across the country. Congress has fully funded WIC for more than 25 years. However, the program's funding needs have grown recently due to higher-than-expected participation and food costs. During a call with reporters, the director of the Domestic Policy Council, Neera Tanden, stressed the importance of the WIC program.
The evidence is crystal clear. WIC means healthier babies who are more likely to survive infancy. Down the line, those babies are more likely to receive medical care. And as toddlers and school children, children who are on WIC perform better on tests of mental development and reading. So really, this funding for WIC and fully funding WIC is a no-brainer.
This is especially troubling because WIC serves nearly 40% of all infants in the United States.
USDA Deputy Secretary Social Torres-Small agrees.
We've seen that it drives down healthcare costs and increases preventative care. Studies show that WIC decreases infant deaths, premature births, and also reduces the risk of low birth weights. And in early childhood, WIC participation is also associated with higher test scores.
If Congress fails to provide the additional funds, the program will see a $1 billion shortfall, and about 2 million participants nationwide will have to leave the program by September. If Congress extends the current funding level rather than providing the additional funds needed, USDA could take measures to protect the program. However, it would only be able to close about half of that $1 billion gap. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.